Registration for Ottawa's Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest is now open, happening May 3rd, in memory of the great Tom Naumann. It's a non-competitive, family-friendly way to identify and pick morel mushrooms on a guided hunt. Purchase your tickets now at visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's April 2nd, 2025. And this is important. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, we'll perhaps know what the status is of tariffs. I'm not even going to use the phrase that the president is using to describe today. We'll know what the result of Tariff Day is going to be, so we'll cut in on that in a little bit. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can listen for me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope from WCIU, What's the Word TV, and a bunch of other platforms.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now doing the Chicago History website on Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my Substack on Chicago government, The Last Ward.
I'm Eric Zorn. I have only one platform, which is the Picayune Sentinel. It's a Substack newsletter that covers state, local, national, sports, comedy, tragedy.
Sometimes those are the same thing. Is the media reading too much into Susan Crawford's victory in Wisconsin, despite Elon Musk's money and stumping? And I'll get to the specifics on that in a minute. The liberal-minded Crawford beat conservative MAGA judge Brad Schimmel to give Democrats a 5-4 advantage in that state's Supreme Court. This could affect abortion, election issues, immigration issues in that state, and of course, arguably most importantly, gerrymandering. Newly drawn congressional seats could give Democrats two more seats in the U.S. House. This is at the same time that two seats in Florida were retained by the Republicans. Is this a big win for Democrats? Is it a push? What do you make of it?
I think it's a big win in Wisconsin. There was another race, if you will, decided in Wisconsin on the voter ID law, which that passed 60-40, which in itself was interesting. You had a lot of people vote for a more liberal Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin while also voting yes on voter ID, which shows, I think, that that issue as kind of a wedge. I think it's impressive. The reason people would say that it's not impressive is that you had a Supreme Court race in Wisconsin in 2023 where the more liberal candidate won by 11 points. And it looks like, and then obviously Trump won by 1 point in 2024. Now in 2025, Crawford looks like she will win by around 10 points. But what's interesting is that the assumption is that a higher turnout race is what the more conservative candidate needed to win. And it was a very high turnout race. So for context, there were 1.8 million votes cast in 2023 in Wisconsin for the Supreme Court race. And this year there was 2.3 million votes cast in the Supreme Court race, and they still kept that 10-point margin. I think that in part speaks to the fact that it was a race that was made federal, in part because Musk came in part because of lots of outside money. In part because Trump actually endorsed a candidate, which I don't think he did in 2023 in this race. But the reality is Democrats are going to have a really big advantage all across the country in these midterms because of the changing composition of their electorate. And at the margin, the Democratic Party is becoming older, whiter, wealthier, more educated. And that has been happening since 2016, since before the 2016. That is not true for Republicans. What does that mean? You're going to have a lot more Democrats vote off cycle at the margin because a lot more Democratic voters are the types of people who do vote
old white
in those
off
cycle elections. I think we saw that a bit in Wisconsin.
I would argue that Elon Musk has met his Waterloo in Wisconsin, a state that has two cities named Waterloo in it.
Ripped from the headlines of the Picayune Sentinel there. Well played, sir.
Yes. I did look at the results from Jefferson County, which is where one of the Waterloos is. And that county gave Brad Schimmel a 6 percentage point victory, but they gave Trump a 16 percentage point victory in November. And the other Waterloo, which is in in Grant County, down in the far southwest corner, gave Schimmel a 30 percentage point victory last night, or went Tuesday night, but that was down from a 46 percentage point victory for Trump in November. And I think you saw this across the country in various races down in Florida, where the Republicans did well, but they didn't do nearly as well as they did in November. And this may have to do with turnout and the propensity for certain kinds of people to get out and vote, but it's not good news for Republicans. And it's not good news for Elon Musk, who went in there and spent somewhere around $20 to $25 million, and capered around on stage and gave people checks and so on. And I think that really turned off a lot of voters up there. My guess is that it either got them to switch their vote, or it got them to stay home because they didn't feel like they wanted this this billionaire from South Africa coming in and telling them how to vote. And my guess is that Trump will now consider Musk to be something of a political loser or an albatross, and will distance himself from him more. I think we've kind of seen at least the beginning of the end of Elon Musk's influence in American politics.
Carolyn Leavitt said today that's fake news, but that doesn't mean anything. Go ahead, Kate.
Right before we got on, I saw that Politico is reporting that the inside sources from the White House say that Trump has told his inner circle that he expects Elon to be stepping back soon. The idea is that probably when that 130-day thing that he had, where he didn't have to be appointed and he could still have all these big responsibilities, I guess that's up in like May or June, that's going to be kind of an excuse for him to go back to his
one
business.
Bat at bat, Kate. All he's done, all the water he's carried for the Trump administration, he lost a judgeship in Wisconsin, and now it's thank you very little. He put in Trump's campaign, $292 million. $292 million.
That's why I don't buy the fact that he's out because of the Wisconsin race necessarily.
Yeah, I think this was already in the.
Yeah, I think that was baked in, and I think. However, do I think Musk helped in Wisconsin? Probably not.
Do you think he hurt?
Potentially. I think there's something to be said for the fact that there are a lot of Trump's coalition that's only going to come out for Trump.
Yeah.
Whereas there are people on the left who will fight that much harder just because Musk is in their backyard.
Yeah, that was the point I was actually going to raise. It seems like we've seen it so far in a midterm election and now this, when Trump is not at the top of the ticket, the GOP doesn't do so well. And so that, if you're a Republican, I think you have to be looking around, like, thinking about the future of the party itself in terms of the MAGA movement. How far can the MAGA movement extend? Can it extend beyond Donald Trump, the person itself? Elon Musk sort of attests to that, that he's extremely unpopular. Who else could it extend to? Are there people that could be the proxy or the successor to that and keep that going? Or is it always going to be sort of a, you know, if Trump's not at the top of the ticket, they don't want it type of situation? And I think you're seeing that trend, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the country election-wise. How it plays out in the future, we're going to have to see. But is the media reading too much into it? I don't think so if they're just reading the trend lines. If they're prognosticating off of 2028 based off of this, yeah, you're reading way too much into it. But for 2026 and seeing where the country may be going and headed, yeah, mood-wise, I think it's a pretty good sign.
It's obviously going to be incredibly close for the midterms, or mm-hmm. Trump would not have pulled back Elise Stefanik and said, no, stay in the House, right? I think I would caution Democrats not to get too, I don't think they're going to get complacent, but don't get complacent, because the two House seats in Florida, those seats were won still by a comfortable margin without Trump on the ticket, 10-15%. So
let me just share with you guys something that I know you already know, but I just want to put it on the record here on the podcast. Campaign contributions to individual candidates for the Supreme Court in Wisconsin are capped at $20,000. Most you can give is $20,000. People with more to spend can give unlimited amounts through political action committees or state political parties. And that's the door through which Elon Musk goes, with his $20+ million to Schimmel's campaign, and then millions more to the Wisconsin Republican Party, so that the party could then funnel money to the campaign. Plus, Musk paid canvassers $25 an hour to talk to Republican voters and get out the vote. And then he gave away $2 million checks. Plus, he paid people $100 if they would sign a petition opposing activist judges who have ruled against the Trump administration. In fact, it's been reported that he offered extra money as a bonus if those people got their friends, kind of like a pyramid scheme. It's the Amway of Wisconsin to sign the petition.
$20 each.
You cannot think of more ways to buy an election than that. That's all the bases are covered. And to be clear, the Uhlines gave $8 million, but J.B. Pritzker gave a couple million dollars, and George Soros gave a couple million dollars. It's like the individual doesn't count anymore.
I think it would have been a huge mistake for George Soros to show up in Wisconsin and dance around on a stage wearing cheese on his head, a cheese hat, and it would have been a mistake for Pritzker to go up there, because there are a lot of voters who feel, as I would feel, if out-of-state people started coming into Illinois and telling me how to vote in a state election. I think it was smart and wise for Soros and Pritzker and some of the other donors to give the money into that campaign, because it's a very important election, obviously. But I think it was a huge strategic blunder for Musk to make himself the face of that campaign, to go up there and get himself so personally involved. He's not really all that well liked. The polls don't show that Musk is a popular figure, and especially among independents and Democrats, that he's going to if he didn't turn off Republicans, he certainly motivated Democrats to get out and vote. And I just think it was an incredible strategic blunder, and I'm sure that Trump now sees him as an albatross. Even though he has a lot of money, Trump doesn't really need money right now. Trump needs your public support. He needs the people to get behind him. And Musk is not helping with that effort.
John, I thought you were going to be heartened by the fact that I think this is an example of why money actually matters less than everybody always talks about. I mean, you had a guy giving out $1 million checks for not voting, but the thing closest to voting that you could do, which is like sign a petition about the issue that everybody's voting on. I always think about Michael Bloomberg's, presidential campaign. That was probably the highest cost per vote of any campaign ever run in the history of the world. And he had more money than any other candidate, and he couldn't win. So often we blame money in politics, but it's often makes more sense and easier to blame voters. I don't think money can really turn public sentiment that much. And if it could, we would have seen a different result maybe in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I should be cheered by the fact that it didn't seem to work, although the very act of it still was offensive to me. But the
problem is Citizens United. Yep. So, I mean, the Supreme Court has been a problem for a while now, not just recently, not just since Trump. I'm remembering Stephen Colbert used to do a lot of stuff around Citizens United. Do you guys remember he set up his own super PAC and raised a bunch of money? I just looked it up because I remembered it was funny. He did such great bits. And he specifically said, we started the Colbert super PAC with a simple dream to use the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling to fashion a massive money cannon that would make all those who seek the White House quake with fear and beg our allegiance in strict accordance with federal election law.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I do want to get to some Chicago issues, and we're not that far away right now from maybe the tariff announcement. But attraction, distraction, guys. Despite the wording and intent of the 12th and 22nd Amendments, Donald Trump says he wants to serve a third term. Is he joking? He says he's not, which we by now know is his way of joking, except that this already signals what we know, that the president loves to create chaos. I see this as a distraction.
Well, I don't think that he is kidding, because he does see an opening in between the two amendments to put himself back into office, and the way he would do that would be to run as a vice presidential candidate. There's nothing
the 12th
that prevents him.
Well, the 12th Amendment says that if you're not eligible to be president, you can't run for vice president.
Well, the 12th Amendment refers to eligibility for the presidency, which when the 12th Amendment was passed, it was just that you had to be 35 years old and a natural born citizen of the United States. Those were the only two requirements. When you add in the 22nd Amendment, and all the 22nd Amendment says is you can't be elected to the office of president more than twice. So the argument using sort of that language is that, well, if you were elected president twice, you can still be elected vice president and then appointed president or inherit the presidency. And I've read some scholarship on this that says that that argument could easily prevail, especially at the Supreme Court the way it is. And people like to fly-spec the Constitution for the exact language, which in this case, it's pretty clear that they screwed up when they made the 22nd Amendment by not limiting the number of years you could serve as president.
Yeah, okay, but wait, hold on a second there. I'm not a presidential scholar, but I do subscribe to the New York Times. And it says here, some legal scholars say that route would be complicated by the 12th Amendment, which states, no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of the president shall be eligible to that of the vice president of the United States. How is he eligible to be vice president if, because it would be his third term, he's not eligible to be president?
Because the 22nd Amendment doesn't say anything about serving as president. It just talks about being elected as president. I mean, it sounds like a fine point, but it's
semantics.
I think it's not the intent of the law. It's a huge loophole. The intent of the law. Or, I mean, I think they passed. I think they passed the 22nd Amendment in order. This was when Truman had inherited the last couple of years of FDR's term, when FDR died in office, and they wanted to make it possible for Truman to then. He was elected once. I think Dewey beat him, didn't he? Oh no, he didn't. when Truman won, that it was going to allow Truman to run again if he wanted to, so he would have effectively served like 10 years as president. But that's why they didn't just say you can only serve 8 years, which would make the most sense. They could say you are limited to serving in the office of president for
one way or another.
Let's say 10 years maximum, and you can only be elected twice. That would have solved the problem. Why they didn't word it that way, I don't know. But I do see a loophole here, and I know there are a lot of legal scholars who see that same loophole.
I am also not a constitutional scholar, but I stayed at a Holiday Inn, and I watched a little bit of CNN last night, and amazingly enough, Lawrence Tribe, of all people, is backing you on this, Eric, says that there is a very good possibility that could work for all the reasons that you just stated. Because the 22nd Amendment is talking about the original eligibility requirements, which is just about being a natural born citizen and your age. And apparently, when they were debating or writing down the 22nd Amendment, they apparently did consider putting no one can
serve more than 8 years.
Serving and not just being elected,
yeah.
But they chose not to. And so if they want to go back and look at original intent there, that also would back up that thinking. Mm.
Even if he decides to run, he wouldn't win in 2028 anyway, right? Like, you wouldn't want to nominate him because he wouldn't win.
If the loophole exists and he's going to use that loophole, then who's to say Barack Obama could not use the same loophole? And is that the battle that the Trump team and the Republicans actually want? Now, do I think Obama would actually do it? I do not. I don't think he wants any parts. But I don't think Republicans want that fight. So 2028, if he runs again, are his shots good? Sure they are. He's still got a very passionate fan base of people who are going to stick beside him no matter what, even through economic hardship probably.
Yeah, well.
Will he be able to get a J.D. Vance to be the guy that leads a ticket? I think that's still to be decided. I think the Trump influence, if the thought of him being vice president is around there and that's something that happens – you could probably keep the MAGA base intact and still be a formidable challenge to a 2028 challenger.
Brandon, would you ask Amber Ruffin to step down from the White House Correspondents Association dinner?
I understand why they did it. Some people are reading it as capitulation to the Trump administration. I didn't read it that way. I kind of read it as, in this time for journalism, this pressing time where the press is under attack, now is not the time for jokes. This is a very serious, and we need to buckle down and get in and focus on us. That's how I interpreted it. That's how I read it. I know Eugene, the head of the White House Correspondents Association, great guy, great journalist, and I don't think he would cower to any sort of Trump administration or any administration. I think it was simply about, this is a pressing time for journalism, a pressing time for our media ecosystem. The industry really is in crisis. And so that event needs to be focused on that and not so much the division that Trump brings.
I would grant you that point Brandon, if they had made this announcement much earlier, if they had realized, you know, back in January or whenever that they thought this is too serious a time, that Trump was doing his Gulf of America, Gulf of Mexico stuff, jerking the media around and so on, and we realized what a serious time it was. They only did this a couple weeks ago, and it was, to me, clearly a capitulation to Trump. They're clearly afraid of him and what he's going to do in the White House press room. And Amber Ruffin said, like, she was going to be rough on Trump. There have been comedians in this at that event for decades and decades, and there've been so many of them: Trevor Noah, Colin Jost, Hasan Minhaj, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, Seth Meyers, Jon Stewart, Al Franken. All these people have been up there. They've jabbed at the politicians and jabbed at the media, and they've done their comedy routines. Yeah, we're in a serious time, but we're often in serious times. I can't read this as just a normal event. And I know times are not normal, but I feel like this was a time to stand up to Trump and stand up to his bullying and call it out on a national stage. No one's going to watch that telecast of that dinner without people up there telling jokes.
I have to go with Eric on this. You know, originally they named her, and I don't know, Eugene, you do, I do not, and I feel sorry for him, actually. If I were him, I'd be like, God, why did I have to get elected this year? But, you know, the fact is, the first thing he did was send out an email to his people saying that she had been chosen because she was perfect for this political moment and climate. So a few weeks later, suddenly she's the completely wrong thing. In fact, any comedian is wrong for this moment. I don't see that kind of turnaround happening organically, shall we say.
The dinner is supposed to be on the 26th of this month. She has now said that she was going to be, quote, terrifically mean. I am with Brandon on this. Eric and I talked about this on the radio the other day. Terrifically mean is not what the press needs to be evoking right now. I told Eric, I'll tell you guys, I can see the coverage of it where she's saying something borderline inappropriate, but hilarious and mean, and attaboy, we're punching back at Donald Trump. And it's the members of the press who are trying to cover, or supposed to cover this with some impartiality, and they're laughing at it. Their presence and laughing at that is a tacit endorsement of that. And I just think it complicates things. It feeds into the narrative that the press isn't out to tell the truth. They're out to get Trump. You can't escape that conclusion that some people will come to.
It's not to you a question of whether or not they should have backed down from Trump, or whether they did back down from Trump. But your position simply is that you don't think it is a good time for them to be having a comedian.
Yeah, I know.
Let's just acknowledge, always is terrifically mean to whoever is president. I mean, that's what the job is.
Justice Berg, we have a 2-2 split on the panel.
We cancel the dinner, man. The whole thing is weird. I feel like it blurs the lines between media and the institutions that they're supposed to hold accountable. Everybody sees them all laughing together. And there is some argument for, like, oh, it's, you know, tale as old as time. Like, we have the court jester go up and it, like, you know, he takes on the king and everybody gets to see that the king could kind of like take a joke and you can kind of spit some truth like directly into the face of power. But I think it's an unnecessary vestige of a different time. And I don't know if it serves a good purpose anymore.
No, I totally agree with you. It doesn't.
That's a good point. I think we're
up to the people they're supposed to be covering. But you know what? This is going to have the Barbara Streisand effect. I presume that Amber Ruffin will deliver her routine in another venue, maybe on Seth Meyers' show, since she is a writer on that show. Maybe on CNN, because she's also on that other CNN funny news show, and I forget the name of it. But she's got plenty of outlets, so I presume she's going to do her routine, and now it's going to get way more attention than it ever would have.
I doubt that people in a year or 2 years are going to be like, oh, man, I really wish Amber Ruffin would have been at the White House Correspondents Association dinner and done a great set. We really miss a good roast from Amber Ruffin right now. Like, I think in the grand scheme, people aren't – it signals, it looks bad. The optics, the optics are bad. I can definitely acknowledge that.
Which optics are bad?
The optics of canceling on her after you already booked her. Like, you already knew she was going to be you know, what she was going to do. However, I will give them this. A lot of things have changed from January to March. So, you know, there's a lot to weigh there.
And you couldn't have predicted.
I think he's right about that.
What he was going to do.
2 years from now, Brandon, we're going to be looking back going, remember when we had a free press in the country and they actually let journalists into the White House?
I think that's why they made the decision.
And
I wanted Kate to explain the Barbara Streisand effect. You alluded to that. What is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was assuming that was, well, basically that somebody once took a picture of Barbara Streisand's coastal house, I don't know, from a plane or something. And then she didn't want the picture to be distributed. So she sued them over it. And because of that, of course, the images were displayed globally. And now everyone knows what her house looks like if they want to.
2-2 on that, with Justice Berg recusing himself for reasons that aren't clear. So we'll just table that for now. The Rascals continue, but first, registration for Ottawa's Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest is now open. It's all happening on May 3rd in memory of the great Tom Naumann. It's a fun, family-friendly. It still says non-competitive. I just want to meet the competitive Mushroom Fest someday. Are people pushing each other over cliffs trying to get at a morel? But maybe they are. This is non-competitive. It's family-friendly. It's a good way to learn about and identify and enjoy morel mushrooms. They've set aside land just for us to do the hunt. It's the Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest, May 3rd, Jordan Block Park in downtown Ottawa. You'll meet there, and then they'll ferry you out to the spot. Purchase your advance tickets now at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. And now more Mincing Rascals. I don't want to get all CTU President Stacey Davis Gates on you guys, but this new teacher's contract in Chicago does sound like a really good deal for teachers and students. Without a strike, the teachers get 4 and 5% raises for 4 years. At the end of this deal, the average teacher's salary is going to be over $110,000. Won't that attract good teachers? Smaller class sizes are built in, more bilingual help, more librarians, more nurses. Much of the criticism in the Tribune editorial today was not about that, but rather the way that the CTU extracted these concessions and the fact that there doesn't seem to be enough money to pay for all of this. I want Davis Gates to negotiate my next contract. I'll tell you that. Austin, is this a good deal for whom? How do you score this one, Austin?
I think it, it's really hard to tell who it's a good deal for. It is a good deal in some sense for Brandon Johnson and Stacey Davis Gates politically, because this is like just a non-issue, and it has been dragging on for so long. One thing that I think is really interesting in the discussion on raises in particular, which is like the meat and potatoes of any collective bargaining agreement, is the CTU gets raises of 4%, 4%, and then 5%, 5% in the out years. And the union was saying how amazing this was. Two notable things about it. The police contract had higher raises than the teacher contract, which I don't think most people would have guessed when Brandon Johnson became mayor. And two, something that isn't in the contract is a prevention of furlough days. And to the last point that you made, John, CPS has a $500 million deficit next year without a new contract. Now they've got a new contract. It's going to be between, you know, $700 million and $1 billion deficit. The first thing they're going to go to kind of close that gap is going to be furlough days. And so you're going to have people not getting paid for several days. And while you might have a raise right now on paper, that could be flat or even down in the out years, because this district has not been serious about its finances for many, many years. So I don't think it's a huge win for CTU. It's definitely not a huge win for taxpayers, because frankly, the school district is broke. They couldn't afford hardly any contract that would have been possible under this scenario. So I think it really just takes off a really politically toxic negotiation off the plate of Brandon Johnson and Stacey Davis Gates.
Well, you clearly neglect the effect of the money fairy that's going to bring all the money to pay for all these things, Austin. I don't know why you neglected that. I'm curious also that, you know, they have the raises – 4% than 5%, but they're not geared to inflation, and inflation could easily be worse than that with these tariffs that we're going to be hearing about any minute now, that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with the economy. And the other thing that really struck me was just what Austin was talking about, which was that they barely have the money to cover what's going on right now, and the out year debts or deficits are going to be huge. And there's really no plan. Brandon Johnson doesn't have a plan B. Stacey Davis Gates doesn't have a plan B. Stacey Davis Gates doesn't care where the money comes from. She's always said it's not her job to worry about that. But as residents of Chicago, all of us are going to have to wonder about where that money is supposed to come from. And you get the issue off the table now, off Mayor Johnson's plate now, but he's not running for re-election until 2027, assuming he runs again. So this is going to be settled one way or the other by then anyway. So what is going to be sticking around, though, is these deficits that I don't know. How are they going to account for them? It's got to be property taxes, right? And Johnson swore he wasn't going to raise property taxes. And I think he's going to just find himself in a huge bind going forward.
So you guys are talking about the political means, the means and the political problems for the mayor. But I didn't talk about that when I set this conversation up. I just said this is good for the teachers. I heard what you said, Austin, and I appreciate that. But if, in fact, the teachers do get paid and the money comes from somewhere, the ferry or property taxes or Springfield, I know the people in Centralia are very anxious to funnel their money up here. Somehow or another, the money's going to come, and you'll have smaller class sizes with more librarians and better paid teachers. That's a good deal for the schools.
But, John, you're assuming – I mean, the contract – is just between these two parties. They can say whatever they want in the contract. If there's not money to pay for it, it doesn't exist. So I think the point about is he politically able to get more revenue into the schools, which I think is very difficult, is relevant to the actual contract.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm thinking a contract you have to honor. You have to pay them. You're suggesting that maybe they would not if, in fact, the money was not appropriated, right, Austin?
You can say we created a position, But that's we're not hiring for it, you know, this is your pay structure, but we got to take furlough days because we got $1 billion deficit we're staring down.
CPS
can't print money.
How do you furlough teachers? Who's going to teach the students?
It would be things like prep days, you know, teacher resource days, those types of things, probably not classroom days.
It would probably be teachers taking on more than one class as well, like having to take on other teachers' classes and stuff like that, which I'm familiar with some practices like that from different school districts. It's not a great thing, but that could definitely be coming. I mean, ultimately, yeah, what John's saying, it's on its face a good contract for the teachers, and good for the students, good for the families. And ultimately, that's a great thing long term for the city of Chicago if all these things can actually happen. But that money part's the big question. The math ain't mathin', as they say. I'm not great at math. That's why I'm in journalism. But when you crunch the numbers, I see, even I can see it ain't, you can't fit this square hole in this round peg.
Another thing, they're supposed to be increasing the community schools from 30 up to 70, I think. Those are extremely expensive, and that can be a very long process. Perhaps it gets so drawn out that most of them don't come to pass, perhaps.
Yeah. I closed some schools, Brandon and Kate. I think that the large schools with smaller student bodies is – I know schools are anchors in communities that desperately need anchors, but the math ain't happening or something that
– The math ain't mathing. I wrote that down. I'm going to use that.
The moratorium for closing schools, the official moratorium for that is up, I believe – the same year that we get a fully elected school board. Am I right, Austin? You probably
know. I think 2026. I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not really a political question until after that. And then, you know, maybe at that point, if they're rolling along on some of their other promises, perhaps CTU would not stand in the way of closing, for instance, that one high school. Is it Douglas that has like 30 students? You know, something that incredibly extreme. It turned out a lot better than I thought it was going to turn out.
Do you guys remember when a big show was made about Brandon Johnson and Stacey Davis Gates and Pedro Martinez all coming together? It was a big, big thing. Look at us. We're standing in unison and we're having meetings. And look at us. Look at us. It's a new day.
Political dynamic that's important to note. And I think one of the reasons this was landed, this was maybe the most important reason, is that Stacey Davis Gates has a election for president of the union internally in a few weeks from now. And she has an opponent. And going into that election with the mayor that you spent millions of dollars on and the school board that you spent millions of dollars of member dues on and not having a contract means that I think she very well could lose her internal union election. So I think that is ultimately probably what landed this.
The Tribune in their editorial just said that because of the dynamic of the mayor and the CTU president being hand in glove, they write, Pedro Martinez did all he could and deserves the public's thanks. Even for this deal, it will be up to the new leaders on the school board and eventually at CPS headquarters continue to play the bad hand the unholy Johnson CTU alliance has dealt them.
Apropos of that is that it doesn't seem to me, and didn't seem to be wise at the time, and it really doesn't now, getting rid of Martinez, who seems to be a really dedicated leader of the school system and someone who tried to navigate this incredible financial problem they have. And they think, well, we're going to fire him because he wouldn't take out a loan. And they're going to have to find somebody good somewhere in the country to run the schools. And someone's going to have to come in and who's going to do some due diligence and look at the books. And I don't know who you're going to get if that person's going to be better than Martinez, who is a product of CPS. I think that's another one of Johnson's regrettable moves is getting rid of Martinez, but we'll see.
He's had a week of posturing and deciding. Mayor Johnson has had to deal with kids wilding downtown, and will curfews be enough or a good idea at all? How's he going to find the money for the new school budget? How about a penalty amnesty for people with unpaid tickets? I like that idea. And as Austin points out in his new The Last Ward, Johnson is about to create his first alderman. Now, what did you mean when you said that?
Well, Chicago is the only city in the country where the mayor gets to fill the vacancies in city council. In every other city in the country, if there's a city council member who dies or gets a new job or is indicted for corruption and leaves office, there is either a special election to fill the seat or the council picks who fills that seat. But in Chicago, the mayor just has this really extraordinary authority. That's in part because this is governed in state law. Like the state of Illinois says, this is how Chicago is supposed to operate. That's not how other big cities operate. So we saw this when Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who is one of Johnson's top allies, Johnson names him to be head of Chicago Park District. And now there's a vacancy. Who fills the vacancy? Ramirez Rosa's top ally, it's Cook County Commissioner Anthony Quesada. So now the council will vote whether to confirm him, I think, on April 7th. So in my opinion, the council should vote not to affirm him, if only to send a message that this practice is ridiculous. Just to give an example of how crazy this skews the checks, and there's just no checks and balances, and there's so much authority in the mayor's hands. At the end of Richard M. Daley's term, at the very end, 19 of the 50 aldermen were originally appointed by the sitting mayor. I mean, he had his own council. He had his own block of people that he placed in city council. And so that's just totally insane. It's not a problem limited to Brandon Johnson, but this happens to be his first pick.
All of his little Elons or, you know, his guys are right there doing his work, doing his bidding on the inside.
Right. And as I'm pretty sure you pointed out when we first started talking about this, Austin, Ramirez Rosa stepped down or got appointed like a day after the deadline so that we didn't get to have a special election for the 35th Ward to elect his successor. And right. Then they're not supposed to be having another meeting until April 16th, but he's calling a meeting for April 7th because on April 9th, he wants to have his guy there, now Alderman Quesada, to vote on setting up this new thing that's going to, what are they calling it, the Green Social Housing Initiative. It's going to be something that will be in charge of spending that $1.25 billion worth of housing and economic development bonds.
So when a vacancy is created on the city council, then what's the way that other cities are doing it? How should we replace a city council person?
You could have a special election, which I think is totally appropriate. Or you could have the city council vote on who should replace. I think a special election's better. Just give people direct democracy. The problem, and you could do either of those in Chicago, I think that would be okay. The problem that's especially bad in Chicago is that there's a huge incumbency advantage to being a city council member, a sitting city council member. So when you have the mayor just shove somebody in there, they then get power over, you know, all the permits in the ward, all the zoning, all this ticky-tack stuff that really matters. And you can really consolidate support around yourself. And then we also have our elections in February when election turnout's really, really low. So when there's really low turnout, that advantages the incumbent. So it's just really an anti-democratic practice, one of many that we have in Chicago. And I think it erodes our civic culture and it gives the mayor too much power.
Austin, I mean, obviously you are campaigning overall for a city charter, and this is just one of the reasons for it. And we've mentioned before in association with your city charter work that Illinois Representative Cam Buckner has introduced a ordinance to maybe, hopefully, establish a commission for a Chicago city charter to be written. But I noticed that a newsletter recently, an email from IPI mentioned it was encouraging not waiting for a charter, I guess, but instead going straight for an ordinance to change the mayor's power to appoint the alderman.
So, yeah, state law, you could change. I think they should. Illinois lawmakers should change this law, and you don't need a charter to do that. But ultimately, you want it in a constitution. You want it in a city constitution, a way that it can't be changed. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I don't think it's forthcoming.
So we are, as we are recording this live, it's 3:22 in the afternoon on Wednesday, and producer Pete is just walking into the studio here and handing me a couple of sheets of paper. Donald Trump has begun speaking to the nation about the tariff plan that he's expected to roll out today, and it's rolling out as we're recording this. Page one, Trump says he will sign an executive order enacting reciprocal tariffs. He said he's about to sign a historic executive order instituting reciprocal tariffs on countries throughout the world. Reciprocal, that means they do it to us and we do it to them. Very simple. Can't get any simpler than that, Trump said. From midnight Eastern time tonight, there will be a 25% tariff on all foreign-made autos.
Well, as someone who hasn't really cracked an economics book since college, I can just rely on what I hear from the experts, which is that tariffs are like taxes, and they get passed along to consumers. And Trump seems to think that there's going to be free money coming in from around the world as they import products. On the other hand, I mean, I do see some value in this idea of reciprocal tariffs, that if a country is going to be charging us a certain percent, we should be charging them that. That makes sense to me. But some of these other tariffs seem like they're way too high, and that at least temporarily, if not for a really a long haul, you're going to see prices of things go way up. And I don't think that's what the public voted for when they voted for Trump. So I think this is a really clumsy move. He's going to try to sell it. But I don't think people are going to buy it when they start looking at what they're having to pay.
It's weird because we've had times in history where presidents have asked the public to endure some economic pain in the short term to benefit in the long run. But usually that's the times of war, like World War II. But none of those times did the president leave that unharmed. Or did the party of the president leave that unharmed? Especially FDR. FDR, they got trounced in the election afterward in the midterms. I wonder what Democrats are doing right now, strategy-wise, to plan for this. In the biggest sense, what will they do if this actually works? Because there is an argument that it could. Will it endure the pain? Absolutely. Will pain happen? But there's a chance that we've seen Trump's base is fervent. They're passionate. They might just stick with it. Whatever effects come from it that Trump wants, they're going to be long-term effects. If those things kick in by 2027, 2028, well, then what's the Democrats' message going to be at that point? So I'm hoping that Democrats aren't just you know, sitting around thinking and waiting for things to implode, because there's a chance that he might be on to something.
Well, that's a glass is half empty.
I haven't heard a single person who doesn't work directly for Donald Trump say that there is any good economic evidence that this will not raise prices and maybe force us into a recession. On the other hand, I suppose stranger things have happened. So, you know, good thinking out of the box there, Brandon. You know what? Maybe Cory Booker will take off like a day a month. to talk to us for 24 hours at a time.
What I'm saying is all those things could happen. Recession, economic turmoil, all those things. And Trump seems okay with that, because in the long term, what he's arguing for is that with autos in particular, autos are made in America. We do more making things in America. We invest more in the United States. If that happens, which would be a long term thing, well, then he was right. Now, what the impacts of that are, who knows? And who's going to feel it and how they're going to remember that at the voting booth? People have short memories very short memories, as we found out during this election. I'm just saying there's a chance here that long term, by 2028, we look back and say, well, it did actually boost the auto industry a little
bit. Yeah, but you'll have a different Congress by then, because starting tomorrow, Toyotas are more expensive. And if you are selling Chevys and people are coming to you because they don't want to afford a Toyota, you're not going to give them a discount. I mean, you're certainly going to sell at the sticker or close to it. Everything just, it would seem to me in the short term, has to be more expensive. To your point, maybe in a couple of years, we build up more plants and then manufacturing makes more cars in America and everybody wins. But that ain't going to happen anytime soon.
I don't know where these things are actually manufactured. A number of Japanese automakers have plants in the United States, and Chevrolet and domestic manufacturers import a lot of their parts already. This is not, you know, the world of like 50 years ago or more, where, you know, you'd everything was kind of domestically done. That we, this international economy is very large, very complex. And it just seems like a simple idea that, well, okay, Ford and Chevy and GM and Rivian or whoever, they're all going to make the cars here. We're all going to prosper. And the Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and Kia and all those companies are not going to be able to sell their cars here. I don't think it's nearly as simple as that. And I think prices on all cars are going to go up.
Well, I'll meet you there. But, you know, there was a video out this week. David Hochberg, our finance guy, or the mortgage guy at our radio station, was talking about it today. There was a Toyota dealer who was walking around. He parked five cars. And he said, this car is made in the United States. Its sticker stays the same. This Toyota is made in Mexico or Japan. Its sticker price goes up. Austin, you're shaking your head. That's not going to happen?
Not going to happen. This isn't going to work for the same reason that pouring 7-Up in your gas tank is not going to work. And this is one of the reasons.
Wait, it's not.
And what you're going to see is the auto industry. Here's a perfect example. We already saw this with agriculture in Trump's first term, where there was all these agriculture tariffs. And then the domestic producers were hurting. And so then we got to subsidize them.
That's right.
It's going to be the same thing with the autos, right? Okay, your input costs go up. The cars are too expensive. Americans are mad. Oh, I know. We'll throw a bunch of tax money at the automakers. So then, and it's just this, like, it's like that Simpsons episode where, you know, there's an infestation of rats on the island, and then you got to send tigers, then you got to send bears that eat the tigers, then you got to get helicopters to like shoot down the bears that eat the tigers. Right? Like, it's an endless, it sucks endlessly. Yeah. This trade war stuff does. And one of the most frustrating things about this is you'll see a group like Heritage Foundation, which for 50 years correctly said why free trade was good for everybody, especially America. And now they're saying, you know, the old right doesn't understand what time it is. It's time to go to war on this. And this is a tool of statecraft we have to use, as if that hasn't always been the argument for tariffs, that they could be used as statecraft. The problem is the tool hurts you. It's a tool you use in war to hurt other people. You know, it's the same thing. Like, it's something you would do to another country in wartime to hurt them, increase the costs of what they're importing. So it won't work. And it's going to be a really expensive lesson. That's my prediction.
I mean, if they do a tariff on Mexican imports, okay, and tequila goes up, you're going to have a lot of pissed off people come Cinco de Mayo. That's all I'm saying. That's enough to activate some voters for sure. Tequila is a pretty free-flowing alcohol throughout the country. So we'll We'll see.
Well, alcohol used to be a much bigger political motivator.
What happened to wine?
Politics 100 years ago, it's all like, should we be able to drink on Sundays or not? And that's how every election's decided.
What happened to wine? Didn't Trump say he was going to tax French wines 200% or something like that?
Same price as usual on my end, but that could change.
Big fat zero, huh? Obviously, we'll talk more about this in our next podcast next week when we, A, get the full text of what the president said, and B, begin to feel the impact of it. We'll close with the big beef this week. Kate's been dragging around a big beef for a couple of weeks now, and she really wants to get it off her chest. And I think the rest of us have been motivated to say, okay, well, here's what's been bugging me lately.
I've actually been on you to bring this up since the fall. That's how long this has been bugging me, because it's something that's been really coming on for a while, which is that more and more delivery people, especially UPS and FedEx, will no longer ring your doorbell when they come deliver things, even when you specifically ask them to. Now, I have noticed, at least by me, Amazon rings the bell, but UPS almost never anymore, and FedEx like will not ring your bell. It's like they're afraid of you. They will not ring your bell. And I started calling and complaining to FedEx about this directly, bitter complaints to FedEx, and changing my account with them to reflect that they must ring my doorbell. They've called me up and talked to me on the phone. Oh, from now on, they're going to ring your doorbell. No, they will not. As I've mentioned many times, I live on the South Side. If you live here, there are just no end of Ring camera videos online showing porch pirates having a field day around me. Sometimes they will actually break in. Anyway, I got to the point where I got my daughter some Chanel perfume for Christmas, because that's what she asked for. And for some reason, they had to send it. I guess they didn't have the one that she wanted at the store, but I had to have it sent to me. I told them they better ring the bell. I make a point of being here on a day when I think I'm going to get a delivery from Chanel on my front porch during the worst time of all, Christmas season, when the porch pirates are just out in force. And sure enough, they left it on my front porch without ringing my bell. I didn't see it for quite a while. And my point to them was, okay, what if this Chanel box gets taken? It says Chanel all over it, the classic Chanel thing. Okay, what if it gets taken? I don't have a Ring camera. I'm supposed to call up Chanel and claim that it got stolen. Why should they believe me? Maybe I just took it and I'm saying it got stolen and I've got to, you know, go through that whole thing.
You know, John has this feature on his show, The Bright Side of Life. I think that you've got an opening now for always look on the dark side of life, where you have your listeners call in and air their big beefs and disappointments.
I can see how annoying that is, though. But I've been told by some people, Kate, that they specifically don't want their doorbell being rung. They don't like I don't know why. They don't like the disturbance. I don't know what they're doing, but is it possible there's a population and the default is more on the other side? Although it seems to me like if you're getting merchandise delivered you paid for, you want to know ASAP, especially where you live.
You know what? As a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, Saturday, mm-hmm. I take the dog for a walk to Starbucks, yeah. Going to get me some hot chocolate, going to get her pup cup. And we pass by not one, not two, but three doorways with big packages on the porches. And I'm not in a hurry, so I stop and I look who it's for and I ring the bell and I say, hey, did you know you got a package here? And every single one of them was like, oh my God, are you serious? Oh my God, I'm coming right down.
What a service to your community.
Every single one of them was horrified to find out that their package was out there because the bell had not been rung.
I got to say, I mentioned to my wife, Johanna, that we were going to be doing this. And she said, all the terrible things that are going on in the world, and you guys are going to complain.
I like this, though. I mean, this, frankly, I'm not buying a
life
Toyota
goes
this
on.
Week.
Tell Johanna, life goes on.
I know, life does go on. I will offer my big beef, which is with supermarkets that require you to use their app to get discounts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind that they ask for your phone number. I don't care if they know that I like wheat checks and so on. But the fact that you'll see something on the shelf, it's priced at a certain level. You get to the checkout, it's a different price, and you'll go, wait a minute, that was supposed to be $2 for $5 or whatever. And they'll say, oh, you got to have the app. You got to show us the coupon on the app. And I'm like, I'm saying, like, I don't want this to be a big technological experience shopping for groceries. So that's my big beef.
My big beef is way different. My big beef is the string of people from older generations hating on the current generation of NBA stars and players. I think it's reached a point where it's out of hand. Yes, the 90s NBA was a special time. However, just because they hit each other does not mean it was better basketball. And I think we need to get to a point where we acknowledge that there's talented players in the current league, and we don't need to say things like, so-and-so couldn't score that many points in the 90s, when if you know basketball, you know they probably could, because if your argument is just, oh, because they would get hit, well, it's not really basketball, right? Right? So the haters, I just saw Stephen A. Smith say something like, Steph Curry would only score 17 points in the 90s, not 52. Who knows? At the end of the day, just appreciate great basketball. We got some incredible players. I'd argue it's the most talented generation of basketball players ever. We should just enjoy it and stop being so hooked on nostalgia.
I may be old, but I totally agree with Brandon. I think that the players today are the most athletically talented, gifted players. And I watch the college game. I've been watching the tournaments, of course. For the women's game, there's no question about how much better they are these days than they were. The men's players, I think a lot of these teams like Duke could have beaten just about any professional team from the 80s or 90s. They're that good. And so I'm with Brandon on this.
LeBron said recently, you may have seen this, Brandon, Giannis would score 400 points a game. And I think he's correct. Yeah. I think he's correct.
I do, though, wonder if Maravich would have, what his game would have been like, you know, with the three-point line, just with the three-point shot as an available thing. Pete just handed me this. Trump says tariffs will not be fully reciprocal given non-monetary barriers, don't know what that means. We will charge them approximately half of what they are and have been charging us. So it's not going to be fully reciprocal. He's going to charge half of what they're charging. So the tariffs will not be a full reciprocal, he said. But that halved figures includes the combined rate of all their tariffs, non-monetary barriers, and other forms of cheating. Trump blames the Great Depression on the fact that the U.S. started an income tax and stopped relying on so much on tariffs. The Great Depression, quote, would never have happened if he'd stayed with tariff policy, Trump says. That's a total rewrite of history. For those of you keeping score at home, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930 is widely viewed as exacerbating the pain.
Wait, I forgot Austin's big beef.
My big beef is, so I was in Knoxville over this weekend at a festival called Big Ears, and it's the best music festival I've ever been to. It was incredible. It's indoor at maybe 10 venues around the city all day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And there's all sorts of different music from all over the world. And you walk or bike around to the different venues throughout the day. So it takes over the whole city. And we don't have anything like that in Chicago, and we're way better than Knoxville. And as I was thinking that, I'm walking down the street and I bump right into Mike Reed, who's this Chicago jazz drummer legend. He was playing there, and Mike founded Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. I was like, Mike, why don't we have this? This is so great. And he goes, I know, I've been saying the same thing. Like, it's so expensive, it's so hard, but we need one of those things. Like, we don't need to take over a park for 3 days. You could do it in several neighborhoods over a couple of days and just do it inside. They had churches, they had restaurants, venues, and it was great. And it was great for their city. So we need that. That's my big beef.
Austin bumps into the most interesting people. We'll wrap it up. My big beef is that I was on a Southwest flight and my bag of pretzels was way too small. We'll wrap it up with that. That's Brandon Pope. That's Kate Plies. That's Austin Berg. That's Eric Zorn. We are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. More ground to cover next week as well. Thank you, everybody. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, campers, well done. Thank you, everybody.
Hey. It was fun. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. See ya.
Thanks, Kate.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.